Let me ask you a question that's not necessarily directly on your subject, but one that kind of surrounds most of the speakers that we get to hear. Much of what happens among theological experts is the interminable growth of jargon and language that becomes further and further elitist, further away from pastors who find it impossible to keep up on any number of specialties. Mm-hmm. And yet, there seems to be an increasing pressure on pastors to translate to lay the new paradigm for Christianity, whichever that is. How do you see your responsibility as a theologian, a professional, vis-a-vis the pastors, in terms of language and the direction? And how do you think the academic or the professional community is responding to
that? Yeah. Well, I think that whenever one writes, whoever the writer may be, you have to have an audience in mind. There has to be a readership that's clearly defined to you. And then I think the only way of defending your writing is by measuring it against whether it's comprehensible to that readership or not. There are books that an individual might write that are written for fellow scholars in the field. And that'll involve a kind of an inside language, I suppose, that within that circle is defensible. But if one regards the audience as an audience of the church, including laity and pastors and other professionals, I think then it really behooves one to make sure that this language is not only comprehensible, but lively and engaging and alluring and true, faithful.
I was talking with a theologian from a seminary, which will remain nameless at this point.
Oh, we all know it's Harvard Divinity, but go on.
Who said that his work had been systematically ignored by many of his colleagues because he wrote it primarily as a bridge between the seminary and pastors and lay people.
Yeah.
That many of his colleagues did indeed have their defined readership. The defined readership was getting smaller and smaller and smaller.
Yeah.
I guess it's just fine. If we take you, for instance, if you have a specific interest in biblical theology and want to write to biblical theologians, and you write brilliant stuff that all the biblical theologians think is great, but all you ever do is talk to each other, then you're really lost to the church.
Yeah.
You're lost to some other place. How do we keep some sort of a balance between specialty and the church at large?
Yeah. Well, there are a lot of biblical theologians that don't have means to communicate or to share with the church, because they're not involved in the church. You know, there's, I would say 80% of that whole biblical guild has just become disdainful of being associated with the church. So I think that's the main problem. I think that if your heart is with the church, and that's really the community of discourse that you regard yourself a part of, well, then there's the question of whether you've got the skill to communicate. And a lot of us have limited skills, and maybe we will be very intent upon and committed to communicating very broadly. And indeed, that can be motivated by some vanity or even a profit motive, too. Maybe you'd like to sell your books, and if you want to, you've got to be able to communicate. And some people simply are very limited in their skills to do that. I think it's very hard to write a good book. It's very hard to get a message across in an attractive, lively manner that will be read and understood, and ultimately that'll mean that your books sell. That's how you communicate. You don't preach well if there are two people that come faithfully every Sunday and love your sermons. You've got to pack them in. And that's I think, something of the same problem. It can get tied up in all kinds of vanity and false motives, but still, if you're the humblest person in the world and no one's listening to you, What's the objective that's being met? So it's a complicated question that you ask. I think it would be helpful to have others reflect, because I certainly don't regard myself as scoring big on that front. You know, my books aren't bestsellers. And I struggle with that problem. Maybe it was Walter Brueggemann that told you that. Could well be, because I know he feels that. There are people that have very, very self-consciously taken a kind of a position of mediating the ideas of others that they regard to be good scholars to a popular audience. And Walter Brueggemann is one of the best practitioners of that, and I take my hat off to him. At the same time, I know he turned a position down at Princeton because he didn't think he was a good enough scholar. You know, there's a person that's really chosen to redress the lack that you point your finger towards. And I think that's fantastic. In my own work, I have written for other scholars, but I've also tried to keep a channel open to the church. But again, I don't regard myself as really succeeding in either of those tasks, frankly. Yeah?
In your impressive theological scholarship studies, what would you consider your major shift over the years you've been engaged in this? What's been your major shift?
That's a good question, too, that I've never been asked before. I think there is an answer. It's that I'm going to do the kind of scholarship that I feel I'm called to, rather than the kind of scholarship that I think my mentors are expecting of me and my senior colleagues. And basically that was just fine to say to someone that I've owed an awful lot to as a mentor, Frank Cross. I finally have to say that my interests, my style are different from yours, and I think I've very, very deeply disappointed him. Because I don't think what I do really is understandable to him. I was picked out as the bright-eyed, blue-eyed kid by just think of it, by Ernest Cross and Frank, by Ernest Wright and Frank Cross. And before I had submitted my thesis, I was invited by the two of them to the faculty club and asked to become their colleagues. And the one wanted me to ease into his position as being the most well-known biblical archaeologist, and the other as the finest philologian of the country. And I have stepped into the shoes of neither of them. And so that took kind of a decision that was hard to make. But I publicly tell you I have made that. And for 10 years, I have been writing what I feel is important for me, and that means that my Hermeneia commentaries now, the contracts are now about 17 years old, and I'm one of the editors, and I still haven't delivered those volumes because I keep writing a different kind of thing. And the same with my interpretation commentary, my Westminster, and so on and so forth. So that's probably one reorientation. That's an interesting question. Yeah, and I wanted to tell you folks that really, you know, let's have fun and ask the craziest kind of question that might be on your mind, because I am not coming here expecting anything than that we can have I've been longing for a chance to talk to people rather than, you know, lecturing to you. That's another thing that in communication that really, really is difficult when you plan a lecture series. I like to hear people, but this Paul Hansen said, he does say something wise sometimes, not just in the wise guy manner, a very wise word that he said when I was just kind of trying to discern from a number of people in my first hours here what they really were looking for. He and I was debating with a model where there'd be a lot of openness in the lectures and discussion input. His feeling was that he wanted to get something solid that he could chew on. And indeed, that was what I had most seriously considered, and indeed something involving a risk to really share with you what has been really exciting me in the last 3 months. I had no lectures to pull out of my file for that. And so until 2 in the morning before I boarded the plane at 6 to save Walt's Institute some $400, I was getting the stuff out of the word processor that I took along. But right now, I'm really looking forward to a chance just hearing what's coming out of your parish. You see, I can continue in this dialogue if I keep my finger on the pulse of the church, because Harvard is really quite removed from that. And yet people keep telling me that we need some folks that have a sense of the heartbeat of the church there. That's I think the good reason I'm there. There are lots of others I'm sure that aren't so good. But to do that in a way that can be sensitive to Eric Sorensen when he comes, and to other sons and daughters, I've got to know what's going on in the church, and that's why I regard this kind of a conference as terribly important for me. So share your hearts a little.
Well, I think one thing that's true, as I listen to all that's been said, and I'm personally both recharged and enlightened again and reminded of my vocation, what I'm confronted with in my congregation are lots of wonderful people who are almost, heart and soul captives, captivated by the culture, and who are... You wonder, I come back and I say, no, I have something that I think you really need to hear, but I'm not sure that you want to. I mean, it's that kind of dynamic that I think that in our best moments, when we're trying to be true to our calling, we deal with, most of the time, we're also so captivated by the culture that, we take this back as a wonderful, warm, bright memory.
Yeah.
In terms of what experience, I mean, the experience is one pastoral, the pastoral office, it had, is 95% of what we do, and it has its own validity, of course, but when you mentioned Walter Brueggemann and that profound concern for the prophetic dimension. Except the only thing that does occur to me is whether or not one wants to think about it. It seems to me that the gathering ecological storm, that the chickens that are coming home to roost, is so real that whether or not we want to think about it, it is a part of us.
I think we've got to find a way of awakening that level of concern in people. I my experience in my own parish and in the many other parishes that I've gotten to know to some extent, is that these are really good people that are coming there, but they are people that are embattled, that are torn, that are conflicted, that find themselves engulfed by this kind of destructive life that holds forth so much promise, but when you get it all, it doesn't deliver. It just simply leaves you empty, and so they're just caught in this kind of tension.
So we wind up being chaplains.
Yeah, and prophets, to challenge, to shake up, but you can do that only if you're trusted, right? If in Phyllis's chart again, the personal element. I really think that's even more important than was allowed in that discussion. The years of seeing that you're not a hothead, and you're not running some agenda of your own and ramming it down the throats of the people, but you are there with their dying, you are baptizing, you are teaching and caring and loving these people. And once that becomes evident, I think that then you can be a prophetic figure and a real catalyst for change. Right in this topic we're discussing, it is a really controversial one, much less so here, and we didn't have many opposing voices. Maybe we'll get them tonight. But I think mainly we agree against Newhouse that indeed the church as church does have to write statements and advocate, does have to go to our centers of government and express itself on matters. But Newhouse's counter-argument, among others, but I think one that is made the most of, is that when you take the church polls, you find out that the people don't agree with the statements. And he argues that this is exacerbating a tremendous break between the hierarchy and leadership of the church, and that includes the clergy, and the laity. And so that's used then as an argument for that other reading of the Two Kingdoms theory, that we attend to the gospel and equip people in their individual vocations to address the political and social issues of our time. Well, you know, I simply can't agree with that as a student of the Bible, because it seems to me, when you see the prophetic office not being that lonely, individualistic office that the Romantic period had it out to be, but rather as the speaking forth of the remnant, of the community faithful to the original and early Torah of Moses. You realize that this is community speaking not by taking a poll of public opinion and then giving back what that opinion is. I mean, that's just a travesty, I think, of the function of the church. But rather, being sensitive by being sensitized by the word and our confessions to God's presence. We've got to discern not where the people are, but where God is present, where God's conflicts are being carried out, where God is advocating. And I think it's pretty clear, again, in general terms, where that is in our world with its terrible, life-threatening problems. And because our people are so much victims of what is destroying us, it would be expecting too much of them to have them produce the prophetic statements that they then should hear us give back to them. To me, that's just a ridiculous notion of the idea of a biblically based, theologically informed, and prophetic church. But still, to preach that hard word, I think, is possible only if these people know that we love them. You know, that we are not there to demean them, to oppose their conservatism, their republicanism, or whatever, but we are united in something which does transcend any of these human citizenships or partnerships or whatever. And it's on that basis then that we can speak a courageous word, and hopefully as a congregation, hearing their prophetic words too, as a congregation, break out of that kind of bondage to which we're all held.
Now, you keep mentioning Newhouse.
Yeah.
I remember some 20 years ago, he was considered a good voice in the social ministry activities of the church.
Yeah.
And published a book by Augsburg. A number of us met in a 3-day conference helping him consider. I wonder, for number one, I wonder what's happened to him.
Yeah.
And number two, if it, what has happened to him is happening to others also.
Yeah. Well, I can say the latter. I don't know what's happening to him because I don't know him as well as some of you here know him. But I'd love to have others answer that. But yes, it has happened to many, and I would say largely as the right result of the Vietnamese War. Peter Berger is another notable example. You know, right on the mark, you know, in leading the anti...
Huh? Mike Novak.
And Novak is another, the third that comes immediately to my mind, too. You know, these people really felt that we could change America and disabuse us, ourselves, of all kinds of evil practices in the world. And then their high hopes were dashed. And I've talked to Peter Berger. He was a member of our congregation for a time, but he differed with our kind of advocacy ministry. But I had the luck of having him on my call list. And I visited him because he was a lapsed member. He was not coming to church. And he gave me an earful. And it was that whole Vietnamese experience converted him to a very different position because we didn't because of his efforts and others, we didn't go through with bombing the hell out of North Vietnam and Hanoi. We didn't finish the job, and we created the boat people, and we created the instability that we now witness in Southeast Asia. And so he has been converted to a different application of the gospel. And he's taken sides with the conserving elements of our society, and Novak is the same thing. This is a very powerful coalition that is loaded with money, because they know the people with, you know, big business and the most privileged of our society know that they have converted these people. They have good friends who are now able to bring God on their side. That's maybe unfair, but that's how I see that whole development. Now, who knows, Newhouse, can answer the first question?
What's that's happening? Helpful what you're saying. It tells something of a process that's been going on, that something that can be of danger to all of us.
Yeah. I think that you know, we've got to hear in our society some Karl Barths who say that religion can easily become perverted, and once it is, it's more dangerous than any other force in the world because it invokes the name of God. And, you know, when simple people see this very big name, theologian, who has done some remarkable things and is extremely bright, they're liable, they're very inclined to listen and perhaps be converted too.
Paul?
Yeah.
With regard to Newhouse, I don't know whether that explanation you made for Berger and Novak also fits, because during the 60s, he was burning draft cards in his church.
Sounds like it does.
But
what happened?
I presume he was opposed, in other words, to the whole Vietnam adventure.
Yeah, as was Peter Berger. Now, it seems like a very close parallel. Except
I don't think you ever wanted to bomb them. I don't think that.
Yeah. No, I was saying that Berger was doing exactly what Newhouse was, but now he has converted to the opposite position.
Now he thinks we should have bombed.
That's right.
Okay.
I'm sorry. Thank you for clarifying that. No, it was my visiting him to find out why he'd become a lapsed member, where he told me that I have been converted to the other position. I was wrong. I publicly declare that this was a wrong way to interpret that whole situation and our involvement in it, yeah. But now, has anyone had a conversation with Newhouse parallel to mine with Peter Berger? I'd love to know what's going on with him.
The argument, though, even gets more slippery, and I'm going to be involved in the argument with Newhouse next month.
You are, yeah.
I see him presenting a biblical paper on it, so I'm very interested.
Yeah.
But the argument is that you should speak out on public issues, but never as a church corporate.
Right.
Only through the lady,
right,
whom we equip.
Right.
That sounds awfully good at first, because it appeals to what we all want, the priesthood of believers, right, really being involved. But finally, it seems to me, want to help these priesthood of believers to come to any kind of moral consensus about what is right and wrong, what is better or worse. Would that be a fair critique?
I think it's a very, very accurate critique, yep.
Well, I think we need Paul speaking in, because he's a layman, so he's here, isn't it? I mean, then you go ahead and do this for us.
That's true. Well, that's one of the subversive reasons, believe it or not, that I've never been ordained. I think you said I chose not to be, but the church wouldn't have me. No kidding. I mean, I never intended not to be ordained. It was always my intention. But if you decide to go to Heidelberg, which is probably a Reformed faculty mainly, although my major teacher was Von Rath, and then to Yale, and then to Harvard, you get lost. And I spoke to every possible ministerium before the Lutherans started inviting me. And you know, I mean, we don't have a defined teaching ministry. And I should talk to Phyllis about that, because, you know, I feel it feels strange to me. I did all of the theological training. I had two parishes that I served as a student that were my charge. And there was, except when the School of Theology in Chicago called me, then they said we'd work out ordination. But I said, forget it at that point.
Paul?
Yeah.
When you were talking about Newhouse, you mentioned, and I don't know that much about it personally, but you mentioned that he has quite a bit of money behind him.
Yeah.
And the frustration that I have with going out and speaking bold prophetic words as pastors is that the ELCA over its last year has lost tens of thousands of members. Yeah. Our budget is 93% and yeah, dropping.
Yeah.
And how do we preach a prophetic word and yet remain an American church which is dependent on the dollar?
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, is it possible to be faithful? Yeah. It seems like faithful is equated with decline.
Yeah.
And the theology of the cross means that we must not increase in membership, but decline.
And decrease the number of those that will be hearing the gospel in our churches. Now, I think that's a terrible dilemma in a social context which is witnessing the population swinging religiously and politically far to the right. And I think that because of this incredible perverted prosperity that we have. You know, the kinds that we serve are the beneficiaries of this at the same time as we are creating an increasingly massive poverty class in our country. So we are in a kind of a very vicious circle that's hard to break out of. I think that we do, however, have to be not just wild-eyed and idealistic. We have to speak in realistic terms and realize that we have to prepare people for this severe word of justice and judgment by acquainting them with the gospel. We have to create a sense of solidarity and trust with our people that is then the context where we can also speak prophetically and honestly in a way that calls our very lifestyles and our economic styles and all into question. And I don't know all the techniques involved in how that can be worked out, but I do not believe that it's wise for us to just scare everyone out of our churches. And I know that we are serving, isn't it true, an increasingly conservative congregation. Isn't that true among Lutherans? I mean, at least that's what the studies, the surveys seem to be telling us.
What you really raise is the question also of, you know, how do you maintain your integrity in this institution, or do you find these simply become, I use the word chaplain intentionally, because yeah, a chaplain is someone who accepts an institution and you merely deal with the casualties. Yeah. I mean, chaplains are there to keep, to patch things up, just yeah, like with the military.
Yeah.
The military chaplain doesn't question the military operation, he simply takes care of the casualties.
Right.
And in many respects, that's in fact what we do.
Yeah. That's
mean,
a tough,
you know,
question.
What always annoys me,
yeah,
personally, one thing is, every time you get a news release from the ELCA, it's always whatever it is, that, you know, the 6 million member ELCA, da 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 da.
Yeah.
As if somehow that was, you know, if it were 7 million, it would be better.
Yeah.
It may be,
yeah,
not necessarily.
Yeah, no, that's a bind we're in. You know, what role are you going to assume? The priestly role, the chaplain's role, the pastoral role, the prophetic? Yeah.
Well, as a layperson, I think one of the problems, at least that I feel, is that the prophetic word that we're getting is one out of intellect rather than out of experience, where I think maybe there's a gap of credibility between the laity and the clergy, because the clergy seem to have much more stability in their occupation and their life now than many of the laity.
Uh-huh.
And so that we're looking at, you know, the laity saying, you know, where is this prophetic word coming from?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm the one that's suffering,
yeah,
and they don't understand me.
Yeah. Well, in this part of the country, maybe you're thinking specifically about sweeping statements about military spending and defense. You know, it's a crucial problem in Washington State, isn't it? Where some of your congregations are really right at the heart of defense industry economies.
But I'm not talking about
that. You're not talking about that specifically.
I'm talking about the...
Yeah. The level of life.
Unless you're suffering, can you speak to the suffering people?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I mean, I'm not asking anyone to suffer, but I'm just saying that in our comfort, can we relate to the suffering people?
Do you think that there is something about ministry, the way it is evolving, that is cutting the pastor away, further and further away from these suffering members?
I think it is.
What are some of these aspects of this development?
I don't want to be honest.
I mean, I think we're all in this room really eager to hear, even if it hurts. I'd love to have a few remarks that hurt. Because that can free us all up to say what we really are feeling. Do you have any clues aside from how it's going to hit some of us?
Well, I guess yeah. I mean, as an individual that has experienced some suffering and some instability, I look upon my life now as one that is very unsure. Whereas I see occupations, not only the clergy, but clergy is one, that there's potentially, and I think, a lot of stability there. I mean, it's like, again, the clergy or the organization has bought into the corporation organization, and I'm a good capitalist, so I'm not against that. But what I'm saying is that salary, stability, pension, all of those things, I mean, it's like I'm on the school board, and one of the things that grates me is that the teachers, after they teach a year, they have tenure, basically. And even as long as they're a mediocre teacher or better, they've got a lifetime occupation. They've got good pension, good health insurance and everything. Or I can't afford health insurance. My health insurance is $1,000 deductible and I've never used it.
Yeah. Well, do some people feel that same kind of alienation from headquarters in Chicago? I'm wondering if some of the problem that we're experiencing is that people really don't feel that organization, which is young and foundering, I'm sure, and trying to find itself, but what we've seen of it so far may not really be in touch with our congregations. Is it also speaking abstractly? Yeah.
I get the feeling that it's not the task of the church, though, to make people feel good. That would be kind of odd to me if our task would be to console people and say everything is okay, don't worry. The environment is doing quite well. Our country is doing quite well. Don't worry. The other troubling point I would like to make is this. When you constantly say that we should preach the gospel, Andreas Osiander in the 16th century suggested that what we ought to do is write little pieces of paper and write there that you're saved, and then hand out these little pieces of paper, and that's the way it's done, and that's the end of the story. And he really challenged the whole church. I mean, what else is there for us to do? And evidently nobody has really been able to answer. And according to some studies made in Harvard, if you tell something to somebody for 40 times, that person will never forget that. So how many times do we have to tell the people that, look, Christ died for your sins on the cross? Every time I fail to say that from the pulpit, somebody comes up to me and says, Pastor, where was the gospel today? And then I ask, well, don't you know what the gospel is? Oh, yeah, I do, but I still need to hear that. And I would like to get out of that to the kind of social action field that you're talking about, to the responsibilities. Because to me, you can deny the Bible in two different ways. You can either say, well, it's not true, or then you can say, well, it's true, but I'm not going to do what it says.
Yeah, well, maybe we should say preaching God's word, because I go away from a service empty as far as the proclamation of the word side is concerned. If I do not hear the specificity of the text laid out for me. And that's what I mean by preaching the gospel. I mean, that's a buzzword and probably too simple, but it still seems to me that in my own need alongside of the Eucharist, what I need is to experience growth and understanding of what God is saying to God's people. And to me, that comes through the gospel. And I need that every Sunday, to answer your question personally. That's how often I need to hear it, every Sunday, at the minimum.
I think about a week like this and trying to relate to people back in Renton. And I don't think there's anything we've talked about that they would connect with, which creates a real credibility gap. How do we legitimately speak to the personal pain that is so very, very real for the people in our pews? The alcoholism, the child that's out of control, the absolute fear of unemployment or the reality of unemployment, divorce.
Well, you know, that those are all subjects, and Walt is there taking them down, you know, for future. I didn't say a single thing about divorce or of alcoholism or of loneliness or of disease. I targeted one very, very tiny area, but at least it touched on one thing you mentioned, and that's unemployment. It seems to me that what we've been discussing here is an agenda for the whole church. It is not everything, and it certainly isn't going to take care of 95% of what you just legitimately named is what you're going to go back and bang. As soon as you descend the hill, you're back in the middle of it and dealing with it, and much more of it than you can adequately handle. But the part we are dealing with is a part, and that is whether we have anything, whether we bear any responsibility for the fact that economically and ecologically our world, our globe, is threatened.
But you see, for the family back home whose 13-year-old just sexually abused the 4-year-old next door, they could give a freaking rip about the greenhouse.
Well, you see, that happens because that world in their life is so torn that they cannot see beyond the hell that they're entrapped in. Their world is narrowed down to the rape of a 4-year-old. And that is because those children have been raised in hell. You know, they have not been supported by shalom. And it's true, if all of our families and congregations reach that point, we will lose the ozone layer. No one will be able to attend to those matters. So, you know, it is a painful thing to realize that that's the state of God's people. That we cannot, you know, how we are just dragged down in the day-to-day so that we cannot think beyond matters like that. I mean, it's often just the church finances. Or it's the repair of the collapsing building and stuff like that. There isn't any time and energy left for fantasizing about the wholeness of God's whole creation. I agree, but with great grief that's what you go back to face. But I think that as a church we have to address global issues, issues of race, of economic oppression, these matters, and exert our influence on global powers that are pushing us towards perdition. I mean, it's not an either-or, but, I can't say that we can draw back and attend only to the personal, because the oppression is not just personal in a complicated world.
Well, if there's anything for this whole concept of dysfunctional families, and then for a dysfunctional culture, society, then being part of the personal stress that Kirby is mentioning, and we all... is a reason. I mean, it's not only that the poor are oppressed, but the prosperous are oppressed. They were talking about economies of addiction in connection with Peru and Colombia. And of course, we have our own economies that are addicted to to producing stealth bombers, which are, the whole world is changing, and we're still geared up for enemies that that don't exist. We're fighting the wrong enemies.
Yeah.
And we have been for 25 years.
Okay, someone else.
Let me make an offer here.
Good.
As the odd bird here, one of the oddest birds here. it sounds to me like you're all planning to be generic Lutheran churches. And in my town, there's at least eight. And it strikes me that among them, there might be some personality in those congregations and among those pastors that would make each of them a little bit different than the other. And that some might be focused as ones where liturgy blossoms and the glory of God is lifted forth with music and creativity, and another one might be a social action Lutheran congregation that engages local issues and global issues, and another might be one that is tremendously gifted in shepherding and pastoral care and so forth. And that's a possibility that we need to recognize as part of the mix. I mean, we are in a pluralistic world where a kind of a cafeteria religion out there. We're not looking for what they've got, and you've got to offer some selection.
Yes. When I don't respond to something, it's not that my heart isn't lifted up by it. It is, but I'm just going to try it, and I'll hold back because there are a lot of people with things to say. Go ahead.
Listening to Kirby, what occurs to me is that a lot of the reason that's happening is because people in our culture and people in our churches are living by the wrong ethic. So my question to you is, as an Old Testament scholar, and as now one who's reflected on the American beginning, I think it's true to say that in both cases, the carriers of those ethics were at least in the beginning a minority in the culture.
The what of the ethics? The carriers?
The carrier of the ethics. We're a minority.
We're a minority, yeah.
I mean, those people down in Jamestown were not the same as the people in Boston.
That's true. Yeah.
Somehow that got, and in the Old Testament, you know, it wasn't everybody who came out of Egypt, and yet soon was. How does that happen? And how can we as congregations begin changing the ethic by which people are living?
Yeah. Well, you know, I'm glad you asked that because that's something that concerns me. I suggested that I don't think we can just simply go back to insisting that everyone carry the Judeo-Christian ethic. But I think that
our congregations, I think would be not quite in the situation that Kirby described in this extent they are if we were living by the Judeo-Christian ethic.
Right, right. I agree with you. But I think we have to accept pluralism. I mean, again, now switching from our identity as congregations and as Christians to our involvement in the culture. I think we have to assume that the culture is not going to buy into that epic. But I think that we are a nation that celebrates the 4th of July and has a kind of a nationalized version of Christmas and other holidays. And I think we have to be very creative in allowing that kind of lifting up of the nation to go on. I think that we have to help this nation to integrate Vietnam, because I think something very remarkable happened there. And I think that can become something that is a scar represented by the wandering, lost Vietnam vets, or it can become a moment of reassessment and growth. And I think that the church, by addressing matters like that are being neglected and would rather be forgotten by a lot of people, by addressing these things can help our national epic to grow and to integrate that into a greater maturity. You know, to be knocked off of our imperialistic props and to have to question the wisdom of a certain kind of position of the world is important. However, we find another reaction to Vietnam, and that is a move from direct military action to destabilization. And I think that we need to address that. I don't know if all of you agree with that, but I think that's what we are doing in the Middle East, in Central America, in we'll watch what goes on in the People's Republic right now. But we realize that we cannot determine the course of the third world nations by direct military intervention, so we'll keep them off balance. And that's what the whole Contra thing is. I'm not sure that our primary objective is to regain control through the Contras. I think that would be a bonus if it happened in the eyes of the CIA. But I think that its immediate objective is to make sure that we don't have a strong emergent Sandinista government that will challenge our domination of the Western Hemisphere. And I think that if we have worries about a destabilization process which is willing to use paramilitary tactics to destroy civilian populations in order to maintain it, we have questions about that, moral questions. I think we have to feed those questions into the public discourse. And it's in manners like that that we can help to allow an epic to continue to evolve, which is something that we can live with morally. Yes. I think there's a question there, Paul, and then you. Yeah.
I'm a little bit troubled about something that we said before, and I think it's very basic. You had said that when you go to church, you want to hear the gospel every Sunday, and that's absolutely right.
What the word in Luther's sense, God speaking in the congregation today, what is being said through that word, and I think that that takes hermeneutical skill and exegetical ability and a passion for Christ's church to let that happen. That's what I want. And believe me, thanks for asking that, because I don't want to hear Christ died for your sin every Sunday. That's not the kind of specificity that word is directing in my direction.
But that's what the lay people think, though.
I don't think so. You know, again, if we don't just kind of stereotype the lay people, because, you know, I really do think, again, that these lay people are like us. They are struggling, and they want to hear that, too. I mean, I have to believe that what is trying to come out in all of us is that image of Christ. I think that new creation is what is yearning for birth, and it was reborn. It began. It was there in our baptism, and we keep subverting that being. And I know that in my life, and I believe that in the life of everybody that comes into our churches. That's why they're coming there. You know, they may not realize that. But that has to that sanctification, we'd call it, has to be nurtured by us. Okay, now Paul, and then let's just sort of sweep people that have not spoken from this direction across like this. Yeah.
How do we keep in addressing any kinds of social and political issues from identification of the gospel with a political posture? I mean, even you earlier said, aren't we dealing with an even greater number of conservatives in our congregations, which being interpreted means if we had more liberals, we'd be more Christians, seems to me, I mean, the last election was kind of bizarre that way. I thought we wound up not being able to vote for either of them. And it seems to me conservatives are hard-hearted and liberals tend to be soft-headed. And how do we find some kind of consistent statement that doesn't tar us with the political seem to baptize them?
Well, that's why I was asking about what people see coming out of Chicago, because I think a legitimate question is whether there is a partisan trend in our church today in certain divisions. You know, one that is really not heeding carefully enough, I think, the implicit warning in what you're asking. Namely, aren't we just taking our own now political bias and holding that up as the criterion for judging other partisan positions, but exempting our own and identifying it with the gospel? And if we do that, we're just an example of the most insidious form of what we're criticizing. Maybe someone can throw light on that.
Here,
yes. Okay. Good. Yeah. You are next. Indeed.
A word from above. Yeah.
A word from above. And they always have that kind of divine tone to those voices.
A couple of things.
in my first parish, among the things that I learned was this. The senior pastor where I was very radically against nuclear arms of any sort and was for even unilateral disarmament. The president of the congregation was a woman who was quite Republican and felt that we really needed to be, these were the beginning of Ronald Reagan days, and we needed to be strong. And I tended toward the pastor's point of view politically myself, but as I listened to them talk, I realized that both of them had the same goal. And that was, they both believed that the nuclear arms buildup was terrible for the world, that a nuclear war would certainly be horrible, and he thought that you protected people by not having them at all. She thought that you protected the weak by being strong. Mm-hmm. And so one way of, I think that the church does lose credibility when it takes one of the two sides and says, this is God's way to deal with it.
I agree with you.
This, yeah. But that's what the church is perceived as doing.
Yeah, I think that's a very, very important criticism of the church. And we have to really look at that and ask whether it is possible for those two sides to really see their oneness in the body of Christ and to recognize that in applying this criteriology of the gospel to given situations that we have to accept ambiguity. But we don't accept it blindly. By seeing those two points of view discussed openly, both of them probably can gain understanding, and the congregation can benefit from it. And then perhaps statements can come out of that which will not be partisan, but above all, we'll have people now that vote and make decisions with information.
The other thing is that I think that if, as I think over most letters of call,
yeah.
They have a lot to say about preaching and teaching and loving the people and caring for them in their times that Kirby was talking about. And if it seems to me that if that is not done, then there's going to be no credibility in speaking of these wider issues. And it seems to me that there's a frustration among a lot of lay people with too much time being spent on the wider issues and not enough on their own issues.
Yeah.
And if they are cared for, if they are loved, somebody said there's no credibility if they're not loved, and I think that's exactly right. Yeah. If they aren't loved, then they're not going to listen to the wider issue. If they are, they're probably more open to a prophetic word.
Yep, I agree. Okay, now we move to you. And, okay, well, we'll go.
This may be off a little bit. What to you is blessing? What does blessing mean to you?
Okay. Blessing, I think, would in its most basic form be a sense of being forgiven and reconciled. To feel that the covenant is restored. That God's grace has reached me and I have accepted it. And that has recentered my life in my God. And then there's a derivative blessing springing from that, then would be a rightness and harmony of my attitude and my action and my relations to others. But I think that blessing would have to start with that, the restoration of that prime relationship.
How does that get communicated with our broken world?
Well, I think that's where it has to begin with each individual Christian, that there is no addressing the brokenness of the world if that brokenness inside is not first attended to. And that's back to what you were saying. If these people do not feel loved, if God's love has not come to them, and if we, by being callous and unattentive to their needs, do not communicate that God above all is love, it can't be communicated to the broken world. I think one has to be healed to be a healer. One has to be filled in order to spill over into the lives of other people.
Maybe that's why we can't think globally, because we're hurting.
I think that's right. And I don't know, maybe we are just hurting so much that we cannot get on with these other agendas, you know? I don't think that's the case, because I've experienced congregations that have an awful lot together, and they are doing remarkable things beyond their own needs. But I do think that where there is such deep need, as Kirby was describing, and you know, that you also point to with that question, that you know, Christ's helpers in the world are going out with a fullness. You know, blessing is experienced and then shared. I think that's how it works.
Biblical scholarship somehow needs to address that. I mean, that Exodus paradigm can speak as meaningfully to the person who is enslaved in their dysfunctional stuff as it can to the wider issues.
Yeah, well, that's a helpful statement to help. I've been troubled by my answer to you. And now you've helped me to see how I should have answered that, because in you know, if we did have each of those other areas of pastoral concern addressed in further light conferences, yes, the Exodus paradigm could be applied to alcoholism. You know, individual bondage is real, but the divine initiative breaking forth to address that, to release the person from bondage, is also the first statement there. Then, of course, even as we hit all kinds of complications when we ask about political bondage or economic bondage, so too in that case we know that the psychological and the social just intertwining of problems that has captivated that person, put that into the bondage of alcoholism, would have to be addressed. And that takes skill and highly professional training. But nevertheless, as far as the paradigm, you know, the theological framework for doing that pastorally is concerned, I think the Exodus paradigm would apply, you know, equally well in that case, because it does highlight the fundamental theological concern there, that without, well, brokenness. But hopefully then some glimpse of promise that leads to the ability to cry out, you know, the AA's first rule, you know, I am an alcoholic. I am in bondage to this alcoholism. That is the first opening that allows the cry, and it allows the grace to come into the person. And then, of course, one could see what sort of response there would be parallel to worship, probably gratitude to God, who does address the broken, you know, who isn't disdainful of the sick, the one who is ill with alcoholism, which allows one then to overcome shame, debilitating shame, which really is what, I suspect, drives one to alcoholism. Emptiness, you know, that there is the possibility of being accepted and loved. I don't know if you noticed, but the one word that to me bathed me in my own talk was God loves you. That's why you are accepted as a people. And that is the word the alcoholic has to hear. I mean, why are we in our various debilitating patterns of life? You know, why do we work ourselves to death? Why do we neglect our families? Why are we friendless so much of the time, you know, especially as males? We haven't heard that. God loves us. God accepts us. The alcoholic is driven to this because in childhood, usually, that word hasn't been heard. Mommy loves you. Daddy loves you. And then the word can be heard. God loves you. And so I think the paradigm would operate the same in that case. And I wish we could get on with all of this. Now we go this way. You have spoken. Have you spoken yet? So yes, please.
I'm chairman of a task force for starting or presenting the idea. We presented it to the council 2 weeks ago of a healing ministry in our church. Mm-hmm. And a lot of what's being said touches on it, but I know that we're going to encounter people who feel that this is a far-out idea and it really doesn't belong to a congregation. And I mentioned it to Phyllis before she left this morning, and she said, oh, I left that out. Mm-hmm. And so I'd like to hear some kind of a response.
To a healing ministry organized in your church? Mm-hmm. Mainly a laity ministry?
Well, it's there's been a lot written about a healing ministry in the church, and the task force on health education and advocacy for Southwest California Synod.
Yes.
A couple of the churches actually that have had an ongoing parish ministry.
Yeah. Well, I don't see how any person from ELCA headquarters could say anything other than that is precisely what we need, given the shortage of pastors and the overwork condition of our pastors, and then this overwhelming need. And there's nothing more Lutheran than that kind of organization of the entire priesthood of believers into the healing ministry. I think it's remarkable, you know, if there are the resources and commitment within a parish to have that kind of a healing ministry. In my own parish, the thing I, as a church council member, hear most often in criticism of the clergy is that with their various and among these very dramatic social projects like our shelter, people can call into the church office and inform of someone else that's ill or this or that, and a visit doesn't follow. And so people perceive that they really aren't, that their needs aren't being met. And I think this is one way that they can, because I know that our pastors just are stretched beyond what they can do. But yet these people are perfectly entitled to a visit when they're in need. I would hope that any church official, which I am not, would tell you, yes, we support this. We give all that we can to empower that ministry.
Our pastor is very much behind it, obviously, but mm-hmm. As I say, I know that there are going to be people in the church who feel a little bit the way people feel about the church getting into politics, you know. I mean, that this is, we don't need this. We come to church and we have our services and so forth and so on.
Well, then it's, you know, the similar problem that we're having here, then it really takes an overall education of the church to be ready to accept this. But it's interesting because, you know, if we didn't have ministries like that emerging, you know, if there weren't questions of advocacy that comes before a congregation that brings up that resistance, we wouldn't even realize that there was that problem. We would just assume that our people are fine and healthy and have a full knowledge of what the Church of Christ would represent. But now, when something that is so right is that I find even, I mean, not, I mean, I can see the Newhouse site, right? But I cannot see any basis for opposing what you're suggesting other than inadequate understanding of what church is.
I talked to one doctor who wanted nothing to do with it.
Yeah. Okay, now let's just continue. Yes.
Could I put my pastor on the spot or did you leave? Steve, are you up there?
Oh, yeah, I'm here.
I'll put you on the spot a second. Speaking to healing ministry in our church, why don't you help this young lady with a statement about that?
About what's going on in our parish?
Yeah, in the healing ministry area.
We used to have the Stephen Ministry Program. some years ago. But what we found is that there are, in many cases, so many more folks who are just naturally gifted, just naturally marvelous at being able, being good healers, and being very perceptive folks, very good listeners. And so what we try to do oftentimes when we get stretched beyond our limits is to call on those folks whom Frank and I perceive to be very good, good, marvelous pastoral caregivers, and they give good pastoral care to Frank and I, as a matter of fact. And so we'll tend to use those folks. And I just did this the other day before I left. It was my day off, and someone was scheduled to go into surgery, and rather than take time away from my family, which is important for my life as well, I called on some folks and had them go visit. It was marvelous. Some people respond very well to that. Just numerous things going on regarding that. It's just an incredible thing. So I think there are a lot of folks around who are very gifted, who just have, you know, as St. Paul talks about the body of Christ, I don't have all those gifts. There are a lot of gifts, for example, with women. There are issues that women face that I'm sure that they never come and talk to Frank or I about, because we're men, and we really won't understand. We won't have that common experience. And so there's some marvelous ladies in our parish who are just gifted in those areas. So we try to do those kind of healing ministries.
Well, we've gone about an hour. You want to take one or two more yet?
That's fine with me, but I also know that people have had a long, long day. And it's often harder to listen than to speak. So why don't we take two more questions or comments and then call it a night? That'd be great. Paul.
From a Roman Catholic perspective, I guess it's a synthetic response to what is the gospel and things going on in Reston. From my own experience, people want to hear me reflect on something specific on one of the three readings. And when they do hear any kind of personal reflection from a preacher, it does touch them. However, there is an alienation going on between Roman Catholic clergy and the people in the Archdiocese of Detroit, which has become nationwide known in the closing of the inner city churches. The problem there is that the church decided to do probably something that had to be undertaken, but to actually do something to close churches, the people were involved in any way. And in not being involved, that alienation that was kind of very subtle, probably very, very diabolical, just became quite obvious. The clergy and the people, far, far apart. The people don't know, the clergy don't know each other. So all of a sudden, the real pain then, the real wound is, everything you've preached to us, no matter how good or sound it was, but everything you've preached to us, you're behaving absolutely differently. You've said you've loved us, but obviously you don't. You're taking our churches away. That problem is more than a problem. I think that touches on the mystery of evil. And I think in preaching, then, not the gospel of middle-class values, because how best to handle a problem of a lot of churches? Well, let's close some. Let's consolidate. Let's call in a firm that can give us all its professional skills for management purposes. And never once did the Archdiocese really check, at least to my knowledge, ever really check to see if the gospel of Jesus was held up side by side with the gospel of middle-class values. I think the problem in the Archdiocese of Detroit on this specific issue is that the gospel of middle-class values was allowed to kind of hold the day, and not Jesus' gospel. And so now the pain going on is very specific. And it seems that the damage that has been done is going to take an awful long, long time.
Ouch.
And all of those things have global implications. Racism. It's my life, my church, my Polish heritage, my black heritage. Well, that's as global as you can get. It's addiction. You're closing churches. These people have all kinds of problems, alcohol, drugs. Well, that's all over the world. It's money. We don't have enough money. Or there are other people who have too much money. There are some people that were willing to give money to keep a church or more than one church open. Can't, we don't want it, said the Roman Catholic Archdiocese. That's global, has global implications too. So I think the gospel of middle class values, I don't know what else to call it, is often what we succumb to as organized churches. And that, I think, is what too often is preached and heard. And I think we have to check ourselves as preachers, individually and as organized into Lutheran or Presbyterian or Methodist or Catholic communions over and over again.
Okay. One more remark. Did I see your hand? Because you hadn't really quite finished your. You asked a question. Is it Frank right here?
Me?
Yeah. Right. Did you?
Oh no! I just put in my passion on the spot.
You were satisfied with that?
Yeah.
Sure. Okay.
No.
Oh, fine. Yeah. Please.
We mentioned several times tonight that there seems to be enough pain. The reason that there is not a response of social concerns is that we're consumed by pain. And I'm wondering whether the Exodus paradigm doesn't have to be pushed one step further. And that's that as soon as the people were taken out of slavery, they rebelled. And then whether that doesn't have to be kept in mind.
How would you apply that?
Well, an observation that I have made in my ministry is that after spending long hours with people in crisis situations, when they get out of the crisis, they're frequently not in church, and they have little or nothing to do with, in spite of all of the ministry that has been spent. It seems that the healing does not produce necessarily the response that now we live in glory to God and we are concerned about what God wants to have happen in the world.
Yeah.
And I think that's the Israelites being brought out of Egypt, got out there, and we're still self-concerned.
Which is to say the healing hadn't really gone very deeply, right? Because the bondage, and I think it's not an accident that what they're asking for is the flesh pots of Egypt. They really are asking to go back to their bondage. I think that's the thrust of that murmuring motif. And that means that they were not freed. They want the bondage. They want the security of bondage. The alcoholic wants the security of the comfort of that feeling of high. And that's still the bondage, yeah.
Well, security is a middle-class value.
Yeah, well, definitely. I mean, there's a great... We shouldn't belittle the power of the middle-class value. All that it, you know, I mean, there's a titillating kind of effect that it gives that is very much parallel to an addiction. And you get in, if you don't taste the exquisite sweetness of a simple life, if you get bound up in all that sugar and chocolate of commercialism, consumerism, it is addicting. One thing I would just say, if I could just comment, I certainly feel the pains that have been described in my life. And I certainly feel the temptations to allow idols to rule my life. I repeatedly have felt in my own brokenness that what has helped me to allow my brokenness to be openness and not a source of despair and then flight into false gods that really can't deliver comfort has been the community that we have found so troubling and have discussed, but nevertheless, in its brokenness, it has ministered to me. I have found that the church alone is the kind of community that I can go back to again and again, knowing that there are people there who will address those needs, not in a way that seeks to exploit them for some neediness or agenda or grand scheme of their own. And so I think that we have to hold up before God with a great deal of rejoicing and gratitude. That God, after all, God's church, that church invisible, that unfortunately doesn't coincide perfectly with the church visible, but the church invisible is still God's gift that is upheld by the Spirit. It won't be let down. God's not going to let that down. And we can still, I should just say, maybe some of you tragically don't experience that anymore, but to me that's the one place in this land of many, many free will organizations where I can go and know that I will meet Christ in another person ministering to me and increasing my resolve to resist these false gods that cannot deliver, these false messiahs that can't lead us. And so I am not despairing. I'm critical, and I guess my kind of turn of mind tends to accentuate the negative. It's maybe a blemish on my part, but I can only tell you that I rejoice and have a great deal of hope for this church. And indeed, among the professions, though I am not one of you, I still hold up the ministry as the most hopeful and promising of all. And that's both for theoretical reasons, but above all, it's because of my students, the kinds of people that I still see going against the stream and accepting this lowly servanthood, underpaid, with status removed in terms of the structures of our society and its values, still seeing that that is where that they can be true to their calling and to themselves. Thanks a lot. You've been really great. I'm sorry, I'm kind of worn out. I've got a sore throat, and I don't feel that I blessed you in the way you blessed me in our conversation, but thanks anyway.